Welcome to our fourth and final episode of Anarchism, Freedom on the Air. This week, we will continue our exploration of the ways in which anarchist ideas can inspire actions towards a better world. Whether it's in the de-schooling movement, in anti-poverty struggles, or in the anti-war movement, anarchists are leaving their mark.
Why haven't you learned anything?
Man, that school shit is a joke. The same people who control the school system control the prison system. And the whole social system. Ever since slavery. Know what I'm saying?
I went to school with some red.
I would describe de-schooling as the idea that children and adults can thrive outside of school, self-generating their own learning within groups and as individuals, and that in fact that compulsory education as we understand it and is administered by the state is in fact getting in the way, is in detrimental to our children's flourishing.
Matt Hearn is a passionate advocate of de-schooling and child-centered learning. He currently runs the Alternative to School Purple Thistle Center in East Vancouver and has previously directed a small alternative school for elementary age children. He's the author of Field Day, editor of De-Schooling Our Lives, and co-editor of Crank Magazine. He also serves on the faculty of the Institute for Social Ecology. We spoke with Matt in Montreal, where he gave a workshop on the topic of de-schooling as part of the 5th annual Montreal Anarchist Book Fair activity.
The system of compulsory education that we're familiar with really has its origins in Prussia. After being dominated by the Franco army in about 1800, a system of compulsory education was organized and defined by intellectuals like Fichte and Hegel and Froebel, who wanted to inculcate children with a more profound sense of obedience, not only to the adults around them, but in particular to the motherland. And when Prussia began to explode economically in the early decades of the 1800s, after the imposition of compulsory schooling, all kinds of American intellectuals and young aristocrats began to pour over to Prussia, picking up the ideas of compulsory schooling and then bringing them back to North America. In 1852, Massachusetts passed the first compulsory education laws in North America, and it took about 60 years for it to spread across North America, although it should be said that, since I'm in Montreal, that Quebec and Newfoundland were really the last places, the last jurisdictions to have compulsory education, and they did not enforce state schooling until after the Second World War. But really what we've got now is a platonically inspired Prussian-organized system of compulsory schooling. What's important about state education is that they understand the idea of curriculum as was organized in Prussia to be inculcating students with a national consciousness and training them to be citizens of the country. And more so as we see the rise of globalization and the effects of it reaching all the way down deep into the school system, the ideas of education are becoming globalized, the curriculums are becoming globalized, and both the assessment and evaluative procedures are becoming globalized, such to the effect that students all across the world are primarily being forced, in particular in developing countries, are being forced to learn essentially the same sets of curriculum at essentially the same rates. And we see that all the time with, for example, Japanese kids being compared to American kids in terms of their math knowledge or whatever. The primary lessons of state education are those of anti-democratic procedures, of children being inculcated in the ideas of hierarchy, in the ideas of petty control and authority, the ideas of bureaucracy. And overwhelmingly, students, when they leave a compulsory state education system where they have spent 5 days a week, 6 hours a day, 10 months a year, 12 years of their life, in institutions over which they had no control over their days, they had no control over how they spend their time, they have no control over the subject matter in which they were learning, Those are the kind of structures and those are the kind of institutions which they seek upon leaving. If you spend your whole life in a particular kind of anti-democratic hierarchical institution, it stands to reason that once you leave, not only are those the kind of institutions that you're going to seek out, but they're the kind of institutions that you're going to reproduce, given very little experience with anything else. As well, the ideas of self-reliance become buried, in that if somebody tells you what to do, how to do it, and when to do it for the entire length of your developmental process as a youth, then when you leave school at 18, it becomes very difficult to try to figure out what you want to do with your time, how to direct your time, how to motivate yourself, because those concepts are, although maybe still buried in the cultural consciousness, are completely divorced from your experience. So it becomes very difficult to run your own life, become responsible, become motivated, be able to take responsibility for your actions, become a generous community member when you've really never had opportunity to practice those skills. And I think those are skills that need to be learned. After the publication of Summerhill in North America, there were approximately 1,100 free schools in America alone. And the idea of free school and the idea of liberatory education, it was flourishing. Since then, after the extreme academic and intellectual backlash of the 80s and cultural conservatives and educational conservatives like William Bennett and the Reagan administration and Dinesh D'Souza and Alan Bloom and Harold Bloom, trying to reassert the certitude of the Western canon and the idea of outcome-based education as a quantitatively evaluative procedure, the free school movement really has constricted itself. It has been resuscitated in certain respects by the homeschool movement. There's a great number of free schools that have reconstituted themselves as homeschool learning centers or just simply kids that have dropped out and not counted, much akin to the way unemployment statistics are skewed. I used to run a little community-based alternative school for elementary age kids. I did that for about 5 years in East Vancouver, and then we merged the school with a larger public free school called Windsor House, and I now run an alternative to school for teenagers and young adults called the Purple Thistle Center in East Vancouver.
The idea of deschooling is obviously decentralist and directly opposed to state control, which are two hallmarks of any anarchist program. What other common values do the deschooling and homeschooling movements share with anarchism?
I think they have to share, I mean, certainly with radical decentralization, but also for the most part, the nature of deschooling has to talk about an anti-oppressive agenda. They have to talk about, I think, necessarily the ideas of autonomy and self-reliance have to be fundamentally linked to anti-imperialism, anti-homophobia, anti-racism, anti-sexism. I think they have to be, because when we're talking about working with youth to describe their own power and to describe the ways in which they can become involved in the community, not just out of the way. Most youth centers, for example, describe their mandate as getting kids off the streets. I like to try to reverse that at the Purple Thistle Center. We talk about getting kids on the streets. And I think in terms of talking with kids to attempt to help them perceive themselves as agents. Agents not only in their own life, but agents in community life, and having the capacity to build alternative institutions, to build alternative lives, and to positively affect the outcome of community development, I think is essential to deschooling. It's always been the lie of compulsory schooling that all children can access them, and compulsory schools are some kind of great big Horatio Alger-like meritocracy where anybody can succeed. Everybody knows through direct experience and through statistical evidence that that is simply not true, that white kids, that elite kids, kids of privilege always do better than kids of color and kids from lower income families. That has to be also right at the heart of a deschooling initiative, which is producing and creating alternative institutions, counter institutions that fundamentally allow not only all kids, but most importantly, the least advantaged kids in our neighborhood, not to have access to educational opportunities, but to have the possibility to actually address the question, what do they need to flourish? That's got to be right at the heart of the deschooling argument. Until we have some shit where we control the fucking school system, we'll reflect how we gon' solve our own problems. The niggas ain't gon' relate to school. Shit, that's just how it is, you know what I'm saying? And I love education, you know what I'm saying? But if education ain't elevating me, and you know what I'm saying, it ain't taking me where I need to go out some bullshit, then fuck education, you know what I'm saying? At least they shit. Matter of fact, my nigga, this whole school system could suck my dick.
To provide an analysis on what anarchism looks like within the African continent, we spoke with Ashanti Alston. We spoke with him on African Liberation Day. Now, can you
Imagine this world with no oppression and no need to dabble in greed and transgression. The solution for murder and prostitution never glorified as pollution. No television.
Ashanti is a former member of the Black Panther Party, Black Liberation Army. He's a political prisoner, and now you're very active as an anarchist. So what does African Liberation Day mean to you?
As an anarchist, you know, I think that my analysis of the problems of Africa have deepened, you know, where I see things now that I didn't necessarily see maybe in the 60s, 70s, and the 80s in terms of some of the problems that Africa suffered in terms of hierarchy that was in African liberation movements that didn't allow them movements to really liberate the different groups of African peoples who were struggling against whatever that colonial power was, Portugal, Britain, France, whatever. So a lot of these African liberation movements that won, if that's what you want to call it, they ended up replacing one colonial power with now an indigenous power over people. Mm-hmm. For example, Zimbabwe. You know, all during the 60s and 70s, you know, we were big supporters of the liberation struggle of the Zimbabwe people. But what we see today is that Mugabe is in power and has been in power for so long. And for me to see him use the land issue, for example, and I feel that he's using his imagery from those days as a liberation fighter to garner support amongst us here in the United States, especially blacks. Yet, he's an oppressor. I mean, it's clear that he's, for me, he's an oppressor. You know, that if he was really serious about the land issue and making sure that the average Zimbabwean people got that land, he'd have done that early on. But now, when his position becomes unstable, he's using that issue, that land issue, and raising the race issue as to cloud. You know, his real intentions is he wants to stay in power, you know. So if that struggle had of remained democratic, because it did have, in its early days, did have a lot of, it was very creative democratically. It brought in a lot of people into that struggle, and women, for example, played a big part in that struggle. But once they won, the guns were taken from the people. A lot of those forms of struggle that people developed, that the women developed, that peasants developed, that workers developed, those were dismantled. And this is tends to be what happens in a lot of national liberation movements, that the people who fought the battles, who won the battles, have their power dismantled, you know, by the new leadership. And the new leadership uses that revolutionary language to justify why they got to impose all these measures on their very own people. That type of awareness, I would like to see more of that brought into play with upcoming African Liberation Day activities. And I think that it's time for that to happen. Well, one, I think that like what we need to do here is focus on those struggles in Africa that are really like grassroots struggles. And there are a lot of grassroots struggles. And there's a lot of struggles in Africa that are not necessarily identified as anarchist or anti-authoritarian. But when you look at them, they are very anti-authoritarian. You know, we're not focused on that. I think a lot of us here are still focused on people like the Mandelas and the Mugabes, who are these big figures, and not look at what's the on-the-ground struggles going on. There's a lot of struggles over there that are very anti-borders, where people are like trading, finding ways to survive by trading with each other across state lines. You know, there's people, there's worker struggles going over there all the time. There's worker strikes going over there, what the Awareness League does in Nigeria, and there's stuff going on in Senegal, same thing with workers. And we need to look for those forms and support those forms of struggles that have more of a chance of going beyond state forms of liberation, which is an oxymoron. It just don't happen when you got a state. People just don't get free, you know. Also, I think that here we need to look at, allow, let that make us focus on us, here and what we're doing, because black people, a lot of us still feel like we're in a liberation struggle because our situation is so much like a neo-colonial situation. And it's not necessarily the same, but we need to see here, too, that we also have those Mugabes over here, people who talk the talk but are so tied to this system, either to reform it or got an agenda to get into that American pie and put some of that in their pocket, that is really, it really doesn't lead to those of us on the ground being free and being able to determine our own destiny.
Iraq Solidarity Project is a Montreal-based activist initiative created in order to provide non-violent support to Iraqis currently suffering under the occupation and to create links between their struggles and projects aimed at countering oppression at home in Quebec and Canada. We spoke with Andrea Schmidt, who recently returned from Iraq with the project.
The heads of state want to start a war. Just from a three-letter word, I'm in a no. In a Babylon style, I'm in a no.
Could you tell me something about your time there and what was the aim of the project?
I was in Iraq for 3 months. Again, I was sent by the Iraq Solidarity Project, as you said. And the Iraq Solidarity Project is a grassroots organization based here in Montreal that attempts to present an opposition to the military and economic domination that is the occupation in Iraq, whether that's by sending long-term delegates over to Iraq in order to monitor and observe and witness to the violence and the oppression caused by occupation forces and the occupation authorities, or to research the forms of economic domination and exploitation perpetrated by Canadian corporations. And then also, of course, they do awareness raising and campaigns against those forms of domination as they're instantiated in occupation here in Montreal and a bit further afield.
Anarchism traditionally views socioeconomic inequality and state authoritarianism as intimately linked. How is the anarchist critique valuable in evaluating the sources of Iraqi oppression under U.S. occupation?
Well, in many ways, I think having that critique, the oppressive face of the occupation is blatantly clear to anybody, you know, anti-authoritarian or not, because the militarization of the country is so extreme right now. The face of occupation is a face of occupation that, you know, encompasses torture and humiliation, as we've seen recently in Iraqi detention camps. It involves the process of detention that is incredibly violent. You know, troops go into people's houses at night, explode the doors, pull people out of bed, not dressed, in a culture that has fairly specific customs about dress and covering of one's body, especially if you're a woman. That involves a range of other humiliations and lack of access to due process. It's also an occupation that right now, we've seen in the past weeks an increase in military activity just in Baghdad where I was. So, you know, you'd have Apache helicopters flying overhead at night, shooting rockets into neighborhoods, American tanks manning streets, shooting after dark at just about anything that moved, which would mean that, you know, taxi drivers were being blown up in their cars at night. So in that sense, you know, I think that face of the occupation is apparent to just about anybody, whereas socioeconomic, you know, drawing the connection between socioeconomic oppression and state authoritarianism comes in handy, is actually, for me, being there, drawing the connection between who was the most marginalized under the dictatorship and the Saddam Hussein's dictatorship, and who continues to be the most marginalized now under occupation. Saddam Hussein and his regime basically siphoned wealth out of the majority of Iraqis' pockets into a small elite's pockets. And those people still continue to be marginalized under occupation. So if you look at the situation in Sadr City, you see not only a heavy militarization at this point in time, but also a situation where people have not had access to good education, even more than the average of 60% of the population of Iraq is unemployed. In Sadr City, it's much higher, where people are 19 people living in a house of, maybe 110 square meters. And you see then the ways in which systems of domination affect people, even in occupied countries, in different ways and create different openings for resistance, but also demand different things in terms of how we extend solidarity and also in terms of how those people are able to and choose to struggle against the forms of domination that exist.
In Iraq's current climate of socio-economic and political disarray, how are anarchist sensibilities being lived out on the ground as a means of both resisting U.S. imperialism and offering creative and alternative possibilities for coping with the occupation and reconstructing daily life?
I think one of the things that I started to see was that people are in spite of the fact that they've lived under 30 years of dictatorship, and in spite of the fact that there's a brutal occupation that sort of frustrates their capacity to make plans in even like a week in advance, because the roads get closed and the infrastructure devolves yet further. People have many dreams for many different projects, and Iraqis that I met were constantly coming up with projects and starting projects. Small newspapers have grown up all over the place, including Al Muwajaha, which is was Iraq's first sort of independent newspaper, and it's an anti-occupation newspaper. Projects for all sorts of things, from elder care to sort of micro industry, carpet weaving and distribution, are growing up, and they're constant plans for these sorts of projects. So that's one way, I think, in which people are trying to circumvent the shutdown of the economy or the Iraqi economy by the occupation and by the chaos that the occupation has provoked. And one way in which they're trying to resist the sort of heavy pressure that the occupation places on their lives and their ability to make plans is just to come up with projects and to constantly be working at building those projects.
The Institute for Social Ecology is located in Plainfield, Vermont. Established in 1974, it is an educational and activist organization that takes an integrative and critical approach in examining contemporary issues of social inequality, domination, and ecological degradation with the vision of reconstructing a more ecologically sensible, liberatory, and humane society. We spoke with Ace McCarlton and Robert Ogman from the Institute.
Five pillars of anarchism are often described as self-management, participatory democracy, mutual aid, self-determination, and direct action. How can these sensibilities, traditionally concerned with the struggle for social justice and equality, inform a movement of resistance to ecological devastation?
But I guess I understand that as a question of trying to articulate the relationship between struggles which are about sort of human concerns, like social justice, inequality, and social movements, and the relationship between those things and things which are defined as ecological devastation, which is often about sort of non-human things like plants and, you know, the landscape and things like that. So what, I guess, sort of social ecology, who was the sort of philosophy of that, was founded by Murray Bookchin, who is sort of a, was once considered an anarchist for many years and now has moved away from anarchism particularly, but Murray founded social ecology as an idea to try to approach that exact question and to try to say that instead of understanding ecological and environmental quote-unquote problems as being something that we need to approach only in thinking about things as non-human things, Murray said, you know, hey, what if we actually thought about it differently and thought about ecology as being something which is human as well as non-human, and something where we were able to rethink the way that we understand nature in general, and reconceived ecological problems like pollution, like, you know, whatever, as instead of being ecological problems in that narrow sense as being about like nature, quote unquote, as being social problems. So Murray, you know, that's sort of his thing, and social ecology's thing is, let's rethink society's relationship to nature in a way that whatever sort of thinks about it as a dialectical relationship between between things which are sort of non-human, the non-human world, and like the social world, and that that is actually going to be what is key to creating a better world, is not simply saying let's fight pollution or let's fight, you know, whales being you know, extinct, but that people starving is a problem, and domination that is social domination is related to the ecological domination. Social ecology in general would see those struggles as being very interlinked, and the way that we dominate one another has a lot to do with how we dominate nature, quote unquote. And even in critiquing the way that we understand nature is really important, and not romanticizing it, for instance, you know, that there's a lot in thinking about, critically thinking about how we even understand what nature is. You know, is it this wilderness? Is it this pure thing, you know, that we can just encounter? What is it? So that's a lot of what the ISE tries to sort of look at around ecological stuff.
Right. The connection that Ace was drawing between what is typically seen as non-human nature as the ecology and human societies as non-nature is an important one that I think even social justice activists have discussed. If we think about the struggles over environmental racism, which basically is where, you know, toxic dump plants or factories or warehouses or, you know, train transports or what have you are built in neighborhoods of communities of color, particularly poor neighborhoods of communities of color. And the way to think about that is the way that the environmental destruction is having also a profound effect on the human society as well, particularly on people in those specific communities who are directly affected by it. The connection of that social justice issue to the issue of participatory democracy, as you asked in the question, or self-management, or even broader than self-management, but self-government even, is a way for such communities to think about the way that ecological issues are social issues. You know, capitalist planning of a city puts, you know, the worst abuses, the worst ecological abuses in the poorest neighborhoods. So social ecology has advanced this idea of self-government, which the term is coined, is very popular now in the anarchist movement as direct democracy, kind of popular governance by the population, who should have a say over what types of technologies and what types of ecological abuses are to be used, and where should they be placed as well. If, you know, how are communities to be planned? So that I think that's the way that social justice issue gets into these issues of participatory democracy and self-government.
Yeah, and I think what Rob had said about capitalism, you know, and the way sort of that the logic of capitalism constructs landscapes, both rural and urban, is something which social ecology has also been very critical of. And capitalism as a logic, the way that it sort of has inevitable growth, that this grow or die dynamic and this growth logic, which is ultimately very anti-human, and creates a lot of things happen then because of the juggernaut, you know, the ongoing hamster wheel of the growth and profit of capital. And social ecology presents not only a critique of that, but says that instead of that, like Rob was touching on, having, you know, people who are able to directly control and make decisions about what would a community which supports not only humans but the landscape and other life forms that we live with, what would that look like, you know, and how could we do that, and that we need to do that, that that's a part of creating, you know, a liberatory and better world.
I was wondering if you could tell me, perhaps in a little bit more detail, what exactly the Institute for Social Ecology is about.
Well, I mean, I think the Institute for Social Ecology has been really fundamental in being a sort of hub or a space in which people coming from, say, the anti-globalization movement or social justice movements, in particular in the last 3 years, they've come to the Institute for Social Ecology and have tried to develop ideas about the changing nature of capitalism in the age of globalization, or strategies, especially. People who came from the Institute for Social Ecology have been fundamental in organizing massive demonstrations like we saw in Seattle in 1999 against the World Trade Organization, and have been important in developing some of the ideas and putting forth a critical analysis of some of the already critiques of within anarchism, and trying to lend a space for thinking through these ideas more fully. It's rare that we have such spaces in which we can come together and think through these ideas, so it's really functions as such a space where people can meet each other and converge and kind of develop their thoughts further.
We were discussing earlier about what has been called green anarchism as a movement which tends to reject and critique technologies of modern society as inherently oppressive, and generally rejects a lot of the organization of our civilization. I was wondering how, in order to get a better grasp of what social ecology is as perspective, how does it differ in your eyes from green anarchism?
Well, some of the major differences between green anarchism and social ecology is that, like you're saying, green anarchism has focused on a broad assault against this idea of civilization. So therefore, it is against not only capitalism and the state and all forms of domination, which anarchism broadly defines itself by, but against technology per se, against social organization per se, against innovation, against modernism, against rationality. And strikingly different from social ecology, social ecology has been an effort to reconstruct a society in a very radical and libertarian type of way, a very different way, rather than an idea of small-scale, maybe hunter-gatherer society, as some green anarchists have advanced as the idea of a green anarchist society, though they would argue against even the term society. Social ecology has tried to conceptualize a society where there are these facts that you've mentioned earlier, self-management, participatory democracy, mutual aid, self-determined, direct action, so that rather than just trying to eliminate capitalism or eliminate economy, we feel the need for forms of self-organization so that we can manage our lives collectively. That includes participatory politics, that includes an economic system for production and distribution. It entails a kind of self-determination or self-differentiation of different types of understandings of the self and gender, all these sorts of things. It's focused a lot on this reconstructive aspect of what would a liberatory society look like.
And I think, the really key thing that you were touching on in there is that, you know, I think the most blanket thing you could say is that many of the folks who are involved with the Institute for Social Ecology don't sort of, whatever, identify or claim social ecology as, like, their thing. Often people identify as anarchists or as simply anti-capitalists or as anti-capitalist anti-authoritarians or a number of other things, anarcho-communists, blah, blah, blah. So social ecology, you know, to me is first, like, a body of ideas which is interesting to react against, but, you know, often I think it's good to be critical and draw from many traditions. But I think in terms of the contrast to green anarchy, what's really interesting to think about is that social ecology traditionally is social anarchism. So it is more interested in how socialness and society can actually achieve or fulfill the freedom of the individual even more than some sort of ideal pure individuality. So it's kind of the idea that through society and through liberatory society, not any society certainly, but through a liberatory society, which is all these things that we've been talking about, self-management, etc., that one can actually achieve a greater level of individual freedom through social organization, which is liberatory. So instead of rejecting the idea that we could organize anything good, you know, what green anarchy tends to do is to say, you know, we have to just throw that whole thing out. The whole idea that we can work together, the whole idea that we could make a human society that would be liberatory, and social ecology rejects that and says, actually, no, what we need to do is take control of society, and we need to do it in a way that is rational and that is human and that is ecological and that is participatory and that is diverse and that really understands things in a complex way is critical. That is the type of society we need, not an anti-society.